This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, July 15, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Senator John McCain says the White House does not support congressional efforts to set parameters for detainees. As the death toll continues to rise in Iraq, we'll go to Baghdad to hear the latest. And we'll hear the final installment of former Guantanamo Bay prisoner Moazzam Begg. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Leanne Caldwell with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A federal appeals court ruled today that war crime tribunals could try cases for detainees held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The case of Salim Ahmed Amdan from Yemen, Osama bin Laden's former driver, is accused of conspiracy to commit war crimes, including terrorism. The decision is a win for the Bush administration's anti-terrorism policy. Today's ruling overturned a decision last year that said President Bush overstepped the limits of the Constitution and violated the Geneva Convention on the Treatment of Prisoners of War. Thailand has approved an emergency decree empowering the country's prime minister with expanded but questionable authority. The reason is to combat escalating violence in Muslim provinces. FSRN's Diwali Sikautau has more from Bangkok.
This royal decree replaces the martial law that was already in effect in some areas of Thailand's southern region. The decree will allow Thai Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat to declare emergency zones and order phone taps, detain individuals without charges, impose curfews, or censor media. Thai Senator Krysak Chunavan says this decree could be devastating for Thai democracy.
It's back to square one. I mean, we would be back in, under dictatorship. Or sort of a guided democracy, or misguided democracy, if you like.
Senator Krysak says the emergency measures will only bring about more violence in the south, where more than 800 people have already been killed since last January. The government blames anti-government groups, including Muslim separatists, for the almost daily attacks. Many Thai Muslims, however, blame the government, citing a long history of discrimination against Muslims in mostly Buddhist Thailand. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Duahli Saikautau in Bangkok.
Both the peace agreement and the tsunami aid agreement between the Sri Lankan government and the rebel Tamil Tigers is on the verge of collapse. Poniam Manikavasagam in Sri Lanka reports.
Tamil Tiger rebels rejected the conditions stipulated by the Sri Lankan government that restricts the number of journeys and number of their cadres into the government-controlled areas for political activities. The rebels announced they may have to start using their own armed escorts for guerrillas traveling through government-held areas, defying Sri Lanka's three-year-old ceasefire and pushing it to the brink of collapse. The rebels began shutting down their political offices in government areas the same day. Two of their senior members were killed by unidentified gunmen. Meanwhile, the military accused the rebels of more than 10 attacks on security forces since Tuesday, wounding more than 30 soldiers. Helen Olafsdottir, the spokesman of the European team monitoring the ceasefire accords, said the situation is a nightmare and most dangerous. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
20,000 police were sent to the streets to monitor thousands of Peruvians protesting negotiations for a free trade agreement with the United States. Christy Lipuma Herrera has more from Lima.
Strikes will escalate and continue until Peru's President Alejandro Toledo hears protesters' demands. Since Wednesday, members of the General Confederation of Peruvian Workers and other unions took over urban centers and major highways. While one major Lima newspaper, El Comercio, wrote off the traffic-causing demonstrations as detrimental to tourism and trade, and also part of union leader Mario Huaman's political agenda for the upcoming 2006 elections, organizers declared them a success. Alongside the unions, thousands of farmers, public workers, students, leftist political groups, professors, and more demanded that Toledo retract his promise to sign the free trade agreement, saying that the agreement would only ensure U.S. dominance of important agricultural markets. Demonstrators of the Peruvian medical industry also protested the agreement's unfair patent rules, which would allow U.S. pharmaceutical companies to monopolize the Peruvian market with patent drugs. Of Peru's 28 million people, the UN reports that 50% live in conditions of poverty, and many die each year from treatable diseases because of lack of access to medicine and drug treatments. For Free Speech Radio News in Lima, Peru, this is Christy Lipuma Herrera.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair told the BBC he is sure that Al-Qaeda is associated with the London bombings. The investigation has moved beyond London to Egypt and Pakistan. In Egypt, Magdi Al-Nashar, a 33-year-old doctoral student studying in Leeds, was arrested for allegedly building the bombs. In Pakistan, investigations began into the travels of Shehzad Tanweer, one of the suicide bombers. One of Britain's leading Muslim scholars was denied entry into the United States without explanation. Rebecca Miles files this report from WBAI in New York.
Dr. Zaki Badawi, an 80-year-old Egyptian-born British resident, arrived at JFK Airport in New York on Wednesday. He was denied entry, detained for 6 hours, and then told to go back to Britain. Dr. Badawi, one of Britain's leading Muslim scholars, had been invited to speak at the Chichawa Institute, where he was to give a talk under the title The Law and Religion in Society. A spokeswoman, Janet Rapoport, for the Customs and Border Protection Office in New York, said when Badawi's flight from London landed at JFK, customs agents had information that showed he was inadmissible. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting from New York.
Internal investigations at the National Institutes of Health have found 44 of the agency's medical researchers violated conflict of interest rules by their relationships with private pharmaceutical companies. Ingrid Drake has more from Washington, D.C.
Congressional inquiry into possible conflict of interest prompted the National Institutes of Health to investigate the activities of more than 100 of its medical researchers. The activities in question relate to NIH employees' failure to disclose paid relationships they have with pharmaceutical and biotech companies.
I don't think the drug company just randomly, wantonly throws hundreds of thousands of dollars at NIH scientists and doesn't expect anything in return.
Dr. Sidney Wolfe, a former NIH researcher who now works with Public Citizen.
They get favorable reviews of their drugs.
The NIH has recently banned researchers from serving as paid consultants, but has not yet implemented rules regarding employee stock holdings. While the activities of 22 employees are still under review, the cases of 9 employees may lead to criminal prosecutions. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake.
And I'm Leanne Caldwell at WPFW in Washington, D.C.
After meeting with Vice President Dick Cheney, Republican Senator John McCain tells Free Speech Radio News that the White House does not support congressional efforts to set parameters for detainees being held in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay. Mitch Jeserich reports from Capitol Hill.
Three of the top-ranking Republicans on the Senate Armed Services Committee have announced plans for new legislation to create a uniform standard of treatment for so-called enemy combatants held at Guantanamo Bay, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Chair of the committee, Republican Senator John Warner of Virginia, says Congress has a role in dictating what the detention facilities can and cannot do. And Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona says the law is explicit about Congress's role.
The Constitution says the Congress shall make rules concerning captures on land and water.
Any type of legislation, which has yet to be made public, would still need the signature of the president, so sponsors of a potential measure are meeting with the White House to try to reach a deal. Thursday night, Senator McCain said that so far, the White House is not going for it.
We also met with the vice president, discussed it with him. He didn't agree, but we're in communication with him.
The push for congressional involvement comes in response to numerous reports of detainee abuse and criticism over not allowing those being held from challenging their detention. At a Senate Armed Services Subcommittee hearing on Thursday, the Pentagon's Deputy General Counsel, Daniel DeLordo, said that the administration would not welcome Congress's involvement.
When we're talking about the waging of war overseas, okay, defense of the country, historically there is latitude, much more latitude given to the president.
DeLordo said military commissions at Guantanamo Bay, which are currently on hold due to court challenges, suffice in giving detainees a proper review, and that such a process should remain in the control of the president.
Your military commissions are a function of the president's commander-in-chief authority as authorized by Congress. As such, they're an extension of his they are his war powers, and it's appropriate to keep the entire process of military commissions within the executive branch for the purposes of that review.
Also testifying on Thursday was former Attorney General William Barr, who served under the first President Bush. Barr says the courts have overstepped their jurisdiction in giving Guantanamo detainees access to the federal courts.
Judges are more and more willing to try to sort of second guess and make decisions that heretofore they've relied on accountable political officials to make, and that's now carrying over into the war area, unfortunately.
Barr also defends keeping detention authority squarely in the hands of the president.
The fundamental decisions that have to be made in war are executive in nature. The framers did not give the commander-in-chief authority to a president because they played eeny, meeny, miny, moe or flipped a coin. They felt that the president, that the executive, had to make the kinds of decisions that came up.
Steven Salzberg, a professor of law at George Washington University, says Congress's involvement in the detainee issue could improve the U.S.'s credibility.
By not bringing anybody to trial, we cast doubt on whether or not these people are such serious criminal elements as we have maintained. And because there is no public presentation of evidence, no one in the world is sure whether the people we're detained are really as bad as we say they are and warrant the kind of trials that we say they warrant.
Newly released information from internal military investigations show that at least one detainee at Guantanamo Bay was forced to wear a dog leash, perform dog tricks, wear underwear on his head, and dance with a male interrogator. Rear Admiral James McPherson of the U.S. Navy was asked whether he thought that was humane treatment.
I don't know whether they're humane or not. When I heard that those were occurring, the first thing that came to my mind is they were awfully juvenile. They were almost like fraternity tricks.
Other military officials at Thursday's hearing testified that such acts violated the Geneva Conventions, contradicting the Bush administration's assertion that detainees were being treated as if they were covered by the international treaty. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
In Iraq today, 8 people were killed in an explosion in central Baghdad as U.S. troops battled guerrillas in Samarra, an hour north of the capital. Amidst ongoing violence, the country's Sunni Arab minority continues to complain of discrimination by a government led by religious Shiite political parties. In Baghdad, David Enders has more.
During Friday prayers at Umm al-Qura Mosque, Ahmed al-Samarai, a member of the Muslim Scholars, the country's most influential group of Sunni clerics, condemned a suicide bombing on Wednesday that targeted a U.S. convoy in Baghdad Jadida, a predominantly Shiite neighborhood of the capital, killing 40 people, mostly children who had surrounded the convoy as troops threw chocolate. One soldier was also killed. The bombing grabbed headlines, leading some Sunna to complain that the deaths of 22 Sunna men earlier this week had gone almost unnoticed by the press. On Sunday, 9 men who had been arrested by the Iraqi army on suspicion of being guerrillas after they brought a wounded friend to a hospital suffocated after being locked in a shipping container. The army has said the deaths were accidental, but many are less than convinced. On Tuesday, the mutilated bodies of 16 Sunna men who had been taken from a mosque during morning prayers were discovered in northern Baghdad. Most Sunna blame the deaths on the Ministry of Interior's new security force, though the ministry has denied involvement. Amidst sectarian violence, Sunna continued to complain of discrimination within civil society. But after his sermon, al-Samarai struck an optimistic note.
We have lost a lot of our offices because of the discrimination against Sunnis. De-Ba'athification was their excuse. All of them have been taken away just because they're Sunnis. They have brought in some people who are unskilled because they're supported by some party. But I think things will be better after the next elections.
Not all Sunna are convinced elections are the answer to their problems. Talat is a doctor in Baghdad.
Now when you enter a hospital, you don't feel that it's a hospital, but like of it's a mosque or Husseiniyya, because of the pictures of this Shia leader or other Shia leader. I don't know why. Even they sometimes obligate women to wear a hijab.
Talat said Sunna doctors in the hospital have responded by calling for Sunna to vote on religious lines in an election for the head of the Iraqi Medical Association being held today.
So before a week they called for a grouping and a list of our candidate or representative. on a sectarian base. Besides the performance and the efficacy in work and the reputation, because they feel that they are marginalized.
Talat is not hopeful the situation will change any time in the near future. He has a 4-month-old daughter, and he and his wife, who is also a doctor, have decided they will leave the country as soon as they are able. Much of his family has already left to Jordan. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
The death toll in Iraq is mounting in one of the deadliest weeks this month. A speeding car bomb exploded in Baghdad yesterday, killing 27 Iraqis, 18 of them were children, and wounding at least 70, including a newborn. Another 8 people were killed in the city of Ramadi, and in Kirkuk, 3 were killed and another 3 were wounded. As the numbers of people who are dead, dying, or wounded in Iraq climbs, fresh blood has become a precious commodity. Eliana Kaya has the story.
The numbers of dead and wounded are rising in Iraq, and constant bombings are creating an urgent and steady demand for blood supplies for the victims. The shortage has led Iraqis to sell their blood to people who buy it for relatives in need. Dr. Ali Fala treats patients at Kirkuk General Hospital.
We need a lot of blood, sometimes more than we can provide. In the last bomb, we had more than 80 wounded people. And you know, one patient with a head injury requires more than 10 bags of blood. That kind of demand is more than we can provide, even if we had a blood bank right here at the hospital. Some people cannot donate blood for their relatives, or they don't have the time to go and find someone to donate for them, so they have to go and buy it from the people who will sell it. But we are allowing people to donate their blood inside of the hospital to the patients, so that we can screen it first for infections.
What has come to be known as a blood trade raises concerns about the equipment used to check blood. Also, a scarcity in blood bags causes a shortage in blood supplies. And the high requirement for blood every day has resulted in desperation from families that buy blood directly from the donors as they stand in queues outside the hospital. Before they can give their blood, donors are approached by so-called negotiators, acting on behalf of families of victims. Looking for a match in blood type, they offer to pay about $20 per blood bag. With unemployment in Iraq as high as 60% in some areas, and most of the country still dependent upon food rations, the money that can be made from selling their blood can be an attractive option. Again, Dr. Fala.
I earn a salary of $150 each month, and the price for one bag of blood can be raised as high as $50. These people selling their blood have to bring food to their children, and now they have to risk their lives to provide this food because there are no other jobs.
While some Iraqis have resorted to selling their blood, thousands of others are donating it for free in tents set up by Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Mohanad Jafar is a member of al-Sadr's movement.
Muqtada al-Sadr has announced that everybody has a holy duty to donate some of their blood for the injured people. So people have been coming by the thousands to tents that were built in Qadamiya, Sadr City, Karbala, and Najaf to donate their blood. There are so many people, you can see them everywhere.
The ability to screen blood supplies for contamination at Sadr's tents is unclear. But the director of the Iraqi National Blood Center for Donations has said that many blood samples at Iraqi blood banks have been found to be carrying the hepatitis B virus. So far, no HIV cases have been detected. Meanwhile, every day, outside the blood bank in Baghdad, hundreds of donors can be seen standing, waiting to donate or maybe sell their blood. For FSRN, I'm Eliana Kaya.
We bring you the final installment of our 3-part series on former Guantanamo Bay detainee Moazzam Begg today. Begg was kidnapped and detained in Pakistan in 2001 and was imprisoned without charge or trial. He spent 3 years as a detainee, first at Bagram Air Base and then at Guantanamo. He was released in January of this year, partly due to advocacy work done on his behalf by the human rights group Caged Prisoners. In this excerpt, Moazzam explains to Wake Up Call's Deepa Fernandez how he witnessed the desecration of the Quran by U.S. soldiers.
The big controversy, of course, was over the apparent U.S. desecration of the Quran, which was reported by Newsweek and then retracted. And you were in there. Did you ever see that happen, or did others tell you that they saw it happen?
In Kandahar was the first incident that I ever heard of, and yes, there were several detainees. They put me into what was called general population, who told me about a soldier from the United States Marine Corps had torn up a copy of the Quran and thrown it into a waste bucket, which was used as a latrine. I'm not surprised about that at all. Why wouldn't they do that? I think that if they were going to treat human beings like that, then the Quran was only a book, as far as they're concerned. It really has no value. If the human being has no value, why should the book? I saw other incidents also in Bagram, where I saw soldiers enter a cell, take a Quran out from the hand of the person that was reading it, throw it onto the floor, kick it around. I saw them distribute. I remember when they were distributing Qurans to new detainees. They'd say, "Extra, extra, come get your Quran. Learn how to kill Americans." And probably assuming that most of us didn't understand English, but I told myself I will record all of these things mentally to tell the world when I leave. Now, I don't want to say that every single American soldier was doing something like this, but it was definitely around, and it wasn't even the norm, but there were significant amounts of cases that took place. If you ask, I think, detainees that have been released from several parts of the world with different experiences held in different blocks and different times and different places, will come out with the similar types of stories. And even people who are held in solitary confinement. Now, if they're all saying the same thing, it means that these things did take place, and there's absolutely no doubt about it. So, again, I reiterate that if they can treat human beings in that manner, then why shouldn't they treat the Quran in that way?
Mozambique, as we are wanting to just talk to you a little bit about the any possible lawsuit and a little bit about the training camps in Afghanistan, just quickly, what was the worst thing that you would say happened to you while you were in Guantanamo?
In Guantanamo, I think it was just being held in solitary confinement for such a long time without any recourse to any justice or family or communication with anybody. In Bagram, it was being beaten and hogtied, as I said, and also witnessing the deaths of other people and seeing children in custody.
That was the voice of Mozambique, who was released in January of this year after 3 years as a prisoner at Bagram Prison in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. If you want to hear more of this exclusive interview conducted by Deepa Fernandez and Pratap Chatterjee for WBAI New York's Wake Up Call, you can visit their website at www.wakeupcallradio.org. The Indian Supreme Court's judgment this week striking down the Illegal Migrants Act 1983 will be detrimental to the interests of millions of Bangladeshis in India, especially in the northeastern state of Assam. The All Assam Students Union launched a bloody campaign in the 1970s to push Bangladeshis back to their land. Indigenous people who feared they would be reduced to a minority in their own land massacred thousands of Bangladeshis, including women and children, across the state. FSRN correspondent Binu Alex has more.
The influx of Bangladeshis over the past decades has been a major issue in India's northeastern states, especially Assam. During the Bangladesh Independence War, many Bangladeshis entered Assam, and regional groups say many never went back after the country gained independence in 1971. Many have demanded the deportation of undocumented immigrants under the Foreigners Act. But to garner the votes of millions of immigrants, the government introduced the Illegal Migrants Act, or IMDT, which granted Indian citizenship to anyone who settled in Assam before 1971. Recently, a Supreme Court order declared the IMDT unconstitutional and directed that all courts hearing these cases would cease functioning immediately. Assam Gana Parishad leader Sarbanand Sonowal filed the lawsuit.
I think this will have a definitely tremendous impact on this particular ground.
The government estimates around 20 million undocumented Bangladeshi immigrants in India. Assam has over 6 million. Critics term the act as ineffective. In the past 22 years, only 5 of the 6 tribunals were functioning, and less than 1,500 Bangladeshis deported. They also point out that India is the only country in the world with two Immigrants Act in place. Samujal Bhattacharya, advisor to All Assam Students Union, is happy that the anomaly of having two anti-immigration acts has been removed.
We had to approach this Supreme Court, and we'd like to clarify on one point that those who entered up to 71, he may be Hindu, he may be Muslim, they should not feel fear here.
IMDT also had an odd provision, making it compulsory for the person who complained about someone being undocumented to prove it. But now, under the Foreigners Act, the person accused of being an illegal migrant has to prove his innocence. All pending matters before the IMDT tribunal would now stand transferred to courts under the Foreigners Act. This literally means deportation to millions of Muslim minorities in Assam. Religious minorities say their only protection from persecution has now been removed, and even the linguistic minorities fear their existence is also under threat. From Ahmedabad in India, Benu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's decision to veto nearly $4 million in this year's budget from funding for the University of California's Labor Research Center is eliciting anger amongst labor groups and Democrats across the state. The cut will reportedly eliminate about 70% of the center's funding. Max Pringle reports.
The governor used his line-item budget veto to eliminate funding for the labor centers at UC Berkeley and UCLA. The center's research issues like health care, workplace discrimination, and the role of labor in the economy. State labor leaders, like the head of the state AFL-CIO, Art Pulaski, have said that the governor's veto is a politically motivated move that shows the governor's anti-worker bias. Gary Blasey is acting director at the Institute of Industrial Relations at UCLA. He says the funding cut is a big blow and is most likely the work of the governor's political patrons.
I don't think it's so much political in the partisan sense as it is that there are some very right-wing groups that have been out to eliminate any form of labor research and education at the University of California for some years now, and they have not given up.
But Schwarzenegger administration officials say the labor centers and their $3.8 million budget were an unfortunate victim of the budget compromise. The University of California gets $19 billion of the $90 billion state budget. Margarita Thompson, Governor Schwarzenegger's press secretary, says given that education funding is going up this fiscal year, funding cuts to one program shouldn't be cause for alarm. She says state labor leaders are free to fund the labor centers on their own.
Certainly someone who is interested in funding a narrow labor institute, such as the Labor Institute at UC Berkeley, we would certainly welcome Art Pulaski if he wanted to come up with the funding. They certainly have shown the fact that they can fundraise hundreds of thousands of dollars for other initiatives. So we would certainly welcome his participation in buttressing that.
Democratic Assemblymember John Laird chairs the Assembly Budget Committee. He says the governor's decision to cut the funds for the labor centers bucks his responsibility to fund a vital part of the state's higher education curriculum.
This is a public responsibility, and it's a public education responsibility, and we really need to look at it in that context. And it's very appropriate to be funded either by the university or through the state budget. And we have the chance to maybe reconsider it through the state budget, but one way or another, we have to continue the program.
The labor centers also occasionally hold workshops on how to increase union membership, how to win more concessions at the bargaining table, and how workers can counteract the negative impacts of globalization. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in San Francisco.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Our headlines editor is Leanne Caldwell. Mitch Jezerich is our Washington editor. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, McMillan, and Eric Klein. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.